Under the wave it is altogether still, alive and still, as nourishing as sleep. Down below conflict, beyond need or will, where love flows on and yet is there to keep, as unconstrained as waves that lift and break, and their bright foam neither to give nor take. One of the most exhilarating experiences I can think of is diving under a huge ocean wave which is about to come crashing down on your head. You dive deep into the quieter water. You barely feel the wave go over. You surface, and there you are facing another one. Down you go again, outwitting the powerful monster by going under it, by making use of the quiet depths. This image of diving is often used as a metaphor for exploring the depths of the personal unconscious, the deep longings and the emotional shipwrecks that lie beneath the conscious selves that we present to the world. And that journey inward, with all its fears and with all its rewarding insights about who I am and what the meaning of my life may be, is seen by many of us today as analogous to the great mythic journeys of the deities and heroes of the past. But the great mythic journeys were more than personal adventures, and they carried more than personal meanings. They involved the acquisition of some treasure or understanding that would be brought home to the community for its well-being. So too with our spiritual journey. Diving is only part of the adventure. We also have to surface, to face the next wave, and eventually to ride one of those waves to shore, bringing with us the hard-won treasures to share with our community. In the ancient myth of Mother Demeter and daughter Persephone, Persephone journeys into the depths, but returns each year, signaling the appearance of new life and hope upon the earth. Carol Chris suggests that our quest has two aspects. One is the spiritual quest, and the other is the social quest. The social quest concerns our struggle to gain respect, equality, and freedom in the society, in work, in politics, and in relationships. The spiritual quest concerns a person's awakening to the depths of one's being and position in the universe. It involves asking the basic questions. Who am I? Why am I here? What is my place in the universe? The importance of the spiritual quest is that the understandings which emerge will inform and shape the character of the social quest. One of the major questions which faces any oppressed group or any group seeking change is, do they want more opportunity and power within the structures of society as it exists? Do they want radical changes in the system itself? Or do they want to reject the system and live apart from it as much as possible? For example, some women feel that the hierarchical organization of most of our institutions is a direct result of patriarchal assumptions, and that no matter how many women achieve status in those institutions, nothing will really change in terms of attitudes toward women as long as the structures stay the same. Such women often choose to live on the boundaries of patriarchal society, involving themselves as little as possible in its institutions. I know a woman who lives much as Thoreau did, staying in a borrowed cabin in the woods and eking out an existence growing vegetables and studying mathematics and occasionally tutoring in a nearby town. Other women feel that radical change is needed, but that they can transform the institutions from within. There is, for example, an organization of Catholic nuns, all of whom have the necessary education and training to be priests. They pressure the church year after year to ordain women, and they fully believe that it will happen. Still, other women are determined to make their way in the system as it exists. They dress for success, run for public office, and demand the same kind of power that men have. As more and more men and women have dived into their personal depths and have asked the ultimate questions about the meaning and quality of life on this planet, there has been less and less agreement about what social changes should be advocated. Sociologist Peter Berger once remarked that it's not religious pluralism, but moral pluralism which troubles us. Perhaps we need to analyze it even further into particular moral positions that trouble us. A few years ago, I attended a most interesting wedding in Seattle. My friend and colleague, the Reverend Lucy Hitchcock, was married to a man from Senegal. Ibrahim had come all the way from Africa to be part of the protests against the World Trade Organization. There he met Lucy, who was heavily involved in organizing and leading those protests. Here were two people, both deeply morally committed to this social justice activity. But then they fell in love. His religion is Islam. No problem for Unitarian Universalists who espouse cultural and religious diversity, right? Well, Ibrahim already had two wives at home in Senegal. So this was not an easy marriage for Lucy and her family, her friends, and her congregation to accept. Well, Lucy and Ibrahim are the kind of people who will put even their personal lives on the line in order to make changes in their world. But there are many who sincerely espouse humanitarian causes but seem apathetic, lacking interest in social action or even in voting. I wonder if the trouble is really deeper than a superficial apathy or hypocrisy. Are they quietly rejecting the system? Are they saying by inactivity that some of the structures and institutions of this society are beyond hope of transformation? Are large numbers of us living at least part of our lives on the boundary? The spiritual quest is not only an exploration of our personal unconscious depths, it also involves a relationship with the natural world. Diving beneath ocean waves is not only a metaphor. It is a very real experience of the complex power and beauty of the ocean. That experience tells me over and over that the institutions that we human beings have invented and constructed do not define the limits of reality, nor the limits of who I can be as a person, nor the limits of what you and I may become as a community. We live most of our waking hours within the institutions of family, industry, schools, government. These structures are in the foreground of our experience all the time. We easily become alienated from our own personal depths and from the natural world. Mary Daly has suggested that we need to journey away from these often dehumanizing social structures which are in the foreground of our experience and make our way into what she calls the background, areas which are above, beyond, beneath, and all around the limited horizons of our institutions. There she would have us create new ways of being in the world. The reality of our ecological crisis has caused many people to look with new eyes at the destruction wrought by a civilization that we had thought was a great achievement, an unqualified good. Historian William Irwin Thompson suggests that we have good reason to withdraw our support from some of the institutions of Western society. In a series of four books, he made the major point that planetary culture is a new stage in human culture, and that it is already emerging out of the decay and disintegration of a post-industrial technological culture. He issued a sweeping critique of our post-industrial culture and then suggested what the shape of the new planetary culture might be. Well, the criticisms are familiar. They've been made by other writers as well. The dominant culture is bent on conquest of nature, of space, and even of mind. It's tied to mechanistic physics. It sees technology as the solution to all problems, even behavior. The industrial culture is dependent upon nationalism, and nations see war as a way of enforcing sovereignty. This culture sees history as linear, promoting a myth of progress and a view of the past which despises primitive pre-industrial culture. Such a view encourages a facile optimism and lacks a sense of tragedy. The dominant culture suppresses consciousness by making matter all important. It dismisses intuition, imagination, feeling as irrelevant distractions. It operates with dichotomies and dualities which it is uninterested in bridging, such as matter and mind, culture and nature, masculine and feminine. Seems unable to recognize that many dualities exist on a continuum rather than separately. The dominant culture exploits the earth, space, and people. It is elitist and defines people economically. It is a culture of large institutions which form an interlocking directorate. And finally, the dominant culture is militaristic, a further manifestation of the desire to control and conquer. Religions in this culture tend to emphasize outer qualities rather than inner teachings, and so are divisive rather than unifying. The new planetary culture which Thompson and others envisioned includes a willingness to take in all past cultures and incorporate their finest aspects. It involves a new relation between human culture and nature, an awareness that everything depends on everything else, a recognition of the limits of the Earth's resources. The new culture would encourage and thrive on experiences of the inner life, which keep us in touch with the forces of the natural world. A new science would embrace art and religion as different idioms in a single language. It would make use of imagination and intuition. The creation of new myths would be encouraged, because as one scholar has said, myth is an act of faith in a science yet unborn. Well, it's interesting, the predictions made some years ago by Thompson and others. He said, technology will be incorporated in a humanized and miniaturized way. It will involve small, scaled-down machines and tiny circuitry, mini computers to make possible a planetary information flow. And I think we already see that. Now, the rest of the vision, We may not have gotten there yet. People would choose to live in small communities which are open to the whole planet. Open spiritual fellowships would include sacred work plus spiritual and intellectual creations. The products would be well made and have the shaker elegance of simplicity. Some say that such communities are already in existence and they would act as radiating centers which ultimately produce change. They will retain a sense of the tragic, of our fears and our lusts, and will encourage conflict in which enemies are not conquered, but loved. A new world polity will emerge in which the planet is seen as a whole, a new worldview whose institutional forms are not yet known. Well, that's one vision. What's your vision? Try to step back for a few moments from the institutions that make up the foreground of your experience. Journey into the background, around and beneath and beyond these social structures. Think of some moments of contact with the power and beauty of nature. Think of the depths of love or hate you have met in human relationships. kind of home would you like this planet to become? What kind of community do you wish to create? Look again at the institutions in the foreground. What structures would you preserve and keep? And what patterns would you let fall away and die? What insight, what truth, what treasure will you bring with you from your journey into the deep? May Sartan writes, "Dear solid earth after ambiguous seas, O gentle sand, incarnate mystery, the body all at rest. I battled waves, the depths of black and green, almost went down, heavy with death, alone, now comforted and blessed. Goodbye to dangerous undertows, dispelled for this calm wisdom never to be told, where two souls melt. The nearly drowned, exhausted swimmer lies a shell in her clasped hand, salt in her eyes, on this strange, friendly shore. It is enough simply to breathe again, to breathe an easy, long breath after pain, nor ask for more."